Today in the podcast, we have Stephen Horowitz. He's the founder and a managing partner of Orchid Black. They're a management consulting company focused on helping companies scale and grow. And we talk about his music passions, but also how that gets pulled into his business life. And one of my favorite quotes he has is about if you're gonna be a good musician, you have to have big ears, which means you have to be a really great listener and like listen for where the holes are, where the opportunities are, and kind of make it work and not just plow through with your idea, which I think is a really great metaphor for business. Lots of other great nuggets in here, so let's jump right into it. Stephen Horowitz, thanks for being on the podcast. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Nice to see you.
So Stephen is the founder and a managing partner of Orchid Black, and it's a kind of a unique business. So maybe as I kick it to you to talk about it, let's hear a little about Orchid Black and then also about your origin story for how you came into music in your life.
Sure, Michael. Thanks for having me. Orchid Black is a boutique growth consultancy. And there's a whole bunch of words that are there, but what it means is we look for technology, software, technology-enabled services, and straight services companies in the tech sector where we can apply our experience and methodology to help them grow faster than the market. And we've got a unique model that we've put together, which places, ultimately our collective success on us as a team. So as opposed to a straight fee-for-service model, and where sometimes the outcomes are less clear, mm-hmm. we focus on what can we enact, what solutions can we bring to the table through a pretty prescriptive methodology and grow faster than the market and generate alpha.
Well, that's great. And maybe talk a little bit about what were you doing before Orchid Black was founded? What's your background?
So my career is kind of in two what I'll call large buckets, big corporate enterprise and then more growth stage, earlier stage technology companies. So I had the unique opportunity of being in the technology reseller channel, the greater reseller channel from the mid-80s. Up to about 2000, when we saw how technology was being deployed by corporate America to go run their business. So everything from PC deployment on desktops to big solutions to ERP solutions and everything that entails, and ultimately ending up with data, the mass amounts of data that we've all been collecting and how to best put that to use. So I did a lot of work in creating go-to-market strategies, strategic relationships around that. And as you know, with technology, very much partnership-driven. And ultimately wound up in Florida here at Tech Data Corporation, where I moved from New York and had a great experience there working on what I'll call, today we would call it business process outsourcing, but it was strategic relationships on a big outsourcing deal, and completed that and then jumped in 2000, like a lot of other folks, with the internet boom, and went over to a very early stage company. And I've been working on early and growth stage companies since 2000.
That's great. I'd love to hear a little bit about your music background. I know, if I'm honest, actually, I'm going to credit you a little bit with my idea to create this this little sub-series I'm doing on the podcast. Because I think when I first talked to you, there was a guitar lurking in the background, maybe on a sofa or something. There it is, right? And I started to notice, that people have, like the things in their life behind them. I just have a black wall behind me, so I don't know what that says about me. But a lot of people, people have, what interests them. And the more I kept my eyes open, I noticed that, lots of people had those things. And I found that I always instantly liked guitar players. Maybe that's a weird bias to have. And you said this morning you wore the tie-dye for me, which I do appreciate. I'm curious, what about, having music in your background, do you bring into your life? And even, just when we were talking beforehand, one of the things you said was, hey, let's just jump in and improvise. And that's something I know I get from music. So I'm curious for you, what about, what's your music origin story and how did it make its way in your professional life?
So I'm going to unpack a couple of things there, Michael. One is what I found over the past 25 or so years is this correlation between technology and music, and not in the way we think about using technology to go create music. But my first startup that I worked in, a true startup, and the founder, Greg Wilson, who I think now is at Google or AWS, we found out after we worked together that his dad was a jazz musician and he loved jazz and improvisation, and he played piano really well. And as we were talking, and just in the world we lived in, it was amazing how many musicians also are in technology. And part of it is the creative aspect of creating something new. So there was this correlation that we found. And the more I dug, like you, you'd find how many people are drummers or pianists or guitarists or, you know, the odd bass player, because we're always looking for a good bass player out there. And it seemed to me that there's this incredible integration, if you will. And, you know, it's funny, in early on, as the Tampa Bay scene, I live in St. Pete, Florida, was evolving, and we created the, you know, like the Tampa Bay Technology Forum. One of the first things we did was a battle of the bands of tech companies. Yeah. And it was a fundraiser, and a bunch of different earlier stage companies got together, and they had their own little team. And, you know, I think 2 or 3 years in a row, it was a really interesting event here. And again, it was just another example of how tech and music are so co-joined.
And you know, so how did it come about that there's enough commonality between all the companies to have enough musicians? Were people talking about it, or where did the fire start?
I think we were sitting around one day, and we were sharing an office with the person who was responsible for putting together this nonprofit, and we just came up with, how do you get people together? And I don't know if it was me or somebody else. Hey, how about a battle of the bands?
Yeah.
Or something like that. And we just went with it, and it was actually very, very popular.
And were you in one of the bands?
I was, 2 years in a row. We put a team together. You know, we had different folks, and everybody would select some songs, a pretty eclectic mix of songs. And, you know, we rented some studio space, practice for a bit to not embarrass ourselves, and off we went.
That's key. And give me your era. What's your go-to band or artist that you play the most?
I'm a product of the 70s, so it's pretty varied. So everything from Zeppelin and, you know, Sabbath and those early bands, mostly that came out of Britain, and migrated my way to the Allman Brothers, Grateful Dead, and more improvisational music, and finally started trying to get my ears ready for Miles Davis and Coltrane and other sorts of improvisational music.
Yeah. That's a word you've used a few times today. Are you, does that make its way into business? Are you someone who likes to kind of jump in the middle of things and improvise and figure it out? Or are you a planner? How did that make its way?
So I think you got to do a little bit of both. And, one of the things that hit me early on, especially with, music that requires improvisation, is you have to have big ears. You have to listen to what the other people are doing, or where they're leaving space for you to play. And I think a lot of that is very similar in building businesses, in that you've got a plan, but building businesses is not a physics problem where there is a linear path to getting an answer. You're constantly dealing with market feedback and taking that into account. And I've often found that there's a lot of similarities between improvising in the moment and addressing what's right in front of you. So if we're playing a song and somebody decides to do a key shift and, you know, calls it out to the group that you're playing with, you kind of want to move over to the next key or an adjacent key. Otherwise, it's right. going to sound like it's going to sound like hell. And I think similarly in business, whether you're building a product or testing a market strategy or hiring new people, you've got to be listening to the environment and what's going on around you. And there seems to be a lot of similarities in having good listening skills and then being able to modify your plan accordingly.
I got to say that I love that idea of big ears. I know that's something you hear a lot in musician circles. It applies so perfectly here. I don't know why I didn't think of it before. Is that something you feel like you developed over time? Put it this way, is it something that comes naturally to you, or is that something you had to develop?
I'm going to say probably a little bit of both. I think you've got to have some natural ability to decipher the tones you're hearing or, you know, how you break things down. But then it's hard work. So, you know, I know you play and you get a group of folks together and everybody's not on the same page all the time. And in fact, you know, creatively, you know, you may be having a great day, but somebody may be somewhere else and trying to get that team together to perform, do extraordinary things is hard. So that part of there's a management aspect of that, a team building aspect of that, that emotional energy that you want to try to get. So there are some correlations. So, you know, it's interesting because, and, you know, sometimes you're like teetering on the edge, right? In music, you know, you might be out there playing a riff or going somewhere and you don't know where it's going to take you. You have an idea where it's going to take you.
Yeah.
And hopefully you could stick the landing. And in some cases, less so with business. But, you know, you've got ideas. They're probably a little bit more formed. It's not always in the moment where you've got to make these split decisions, but trying to traverse that path and sometimes connect different spatial points, right? Because oftentimes we're looking, and I know you and I've talked about, looked at a couple of deals together, and you can't look at it always in a box. You've got to look at, you know, what's influencing on the outside? What's the environment like? And I think there's a lot of correlation to music as well, you know, from that business standpoint.
That's really interesting. And it's funny, and especially in a situation like you often get yourself into where you're coming into a company cold and even kind of, I think in many times coming in as an operator, sometimes the rest of the people in that group, don't have big ears and aren't listening and maybe want to and are amateurs about it. How do you, coming into a new business situation, how do you sort of assess the rest of the players and how it's all going to work together? What's your strategy?
So it's a great question. There are some core things that I do and I think we do in general. And you've got to create an environment where the people feel non-threatened. And that's really important, where it's okay to make mistakes, right? I can't, you know, how many times have we all hit the wrong passing note or my God, what was that? But, you know, there's in business, you're not going to hit it out of the park every time. And giving people the freedom in sort of a safe manner to kind of tell you really what they're thinking, not what the political answer needs to be. So creating that safe environment is important. And often we do a lot of workshops. So we'll, typically we'll interview most of the key stakeholders. We'll talk to clients. We'll talk to deals they lost. We'll talk to their partners. And we're getting a pretty good point of view as to what the opportunities might be. And then we'll bring back to those folks again in a sort of a workshop-like manner to get them engaged. And, you know, sometimes you find people who are like, I don't like change.
Right.
And if they don't like change, depending on, you know, the growth strategy, we probably are not a good fit for them. So what's your risk profile? You know, how adaptable are you to change? How good are you at communicating? Because at the end of the day, you know, we work for the shareholders. We work for the stakeholders. We work for the owner operators of these businesses. And they've got to be really comfortable that they can communicate with the right level of transparency and give people that validation that they're part of the process.
Yeah. It's really good. You remind me of a story that I hope I get the players right about. You're talking about, you know, creating an atmosphere of trust where people can just kind of open up and you know, tell the truth. I think it is a John Coltrane story from being in the Miles Davis band where, you know, going through some changes, he played a wrong note. And Miles' response was to play a harmony of that wrong note, and the next time through, play it again. And so at a certain point, it became like, okay, that's the new melody. And just being so him being so shocked that someone was such a good listener that they were able to adapt and change the form of what they were doing to make it work. And I think, you know, that sort of, you know, pulling it into business a lot. You know, we're in a lot of situations where you're thrown a curveball. And there's really no changing the curveball. This is the situation. Now, how are we going to get out of it? I'm curious. That seems like that might resonate with you.
Totally. And, you know, as you were giving that story, I was flipping through the channels recently, and there was some sort of documentary on Motown and Gordy Berry. And, all right. And one of the things he did, which I found fat, because if you think about how many hits came out of that little house in mm-hmm. a short amount of time. And there were competing songwriting groups, right? You had Smokey's team and you had I remember the other guys, the three names. And what the atmosphere that he took from business into music was quality control on the Ford assembly line. And everybody mm-hmm. looking at the aftermath and in a very non-judgmental way, even yeah. what do you think about this tune? Like letting people mm-hmm. provide that feedback, and it made for a better outcome, right? And it forced those to work collaboratively, and the ones who couldn't work collaboratively didn't make it. So right. It's interesting.
It's funny. There's been a lot of that good music content on all the million channels now. And one of the things I've seen seep in is this idea that there's a value to the business side of music where some kind of manager, producer kind of person comes in. I'm thinking of the Beatles documentary that was awesome. And one of the things that became to me kind of like wildly apparent was that when they lost the person who was in charge of like cracking the whip about let's do some recording, they went from doing two albums a year to it took them 3 years to get one out. And it was kind of weird and they had to do it again. It was just like really like the management side kind of fell apart. And it's one of those things. It's an amazing, I haven't seen the Berry Gordy one about the assembly line thing, but it makes sense because, you know, what you're doing is trying to produce something. It's creative. It's a creative process, but if it's not any good, there's really nothing there for
it. Yeah, you know, I know this is interesting. And the other part I walked away from that was at some point creativity has to have boundaries. And then you've mm-hmm. got to put it into practice. And Paul in that documentary, he's the creative driving force, right? You know, John, this is what I'm hearing. Paul, Ringo, like literally showing them the pieces. But yeah. once he's done with that, you know, he's sort of cracking the whip. They all had to come together to produce that great music that still lasts, you know, 50 plus years later.
Yeah, it's so amazing. And it's funny, as we're talking here, you know, one of the things that I often think about is like what about being a performer? So we've talked a little bit about the creative process. And one of the things I always think about getting from being a performer is the confidence and wherewithal just to be in front of people and have that not be a problem. It's one of those things, you know, you're a kid, you got to speak in front of the class and it's always, you know, nerve wracking and some people figure it out and others don't. And I'm curious if that's something you've ever brought into your world.
It's interesting you say that because I actually thought about that recently. Those early high school dance band things where you had to get up in mm-hmm. front of your peers and yeah. do it was a great learning experience because nothing ever goes right. You know that, right? You show up you know, whether a guitar string breaks or somebody dropped an amp head or something happens, you've got to adapt in the moment and you've got to, as best as possible, get your anxiety level to right mm-hmm. where you've got enough adrenaline to do what you need to do, but not go overboard. Yeah. I think it's It's good training for getting up in front of groups, but also in many cases, if you're a founder, you got to talk to investors. Mm-hmm. And they're the ultimate critic of your idea or your plan. And, you know, if you've got thin skin, that's a very unpleasant process to go through. So I think there is those life lessons are probably pretty valuable.
That's, you know, I'd love to hear more about your founder experience, because that's I was a founder as well. And the number of hats that one has to wear, and maybe even in a day or an hour, is can be kind of mind boggling. And kind of shifting gears has been, something that you need to do. So I'm curious for you, do you find yourself in an hour talking to an investor, trying to motivate a team, trying to train somebody? Like, what's your founder experience like in that sense?
There are times when within an hour you could run the full gamut of conversations. I think that's maybe the exception, but the part that's important is knowing your audience and trying mm-hmm. to get the right message. And not that the message changes, but how you deliver the message to team members we've all seen the really sales forward CEOs who don't mm-hmm. always remember exactly all the nuances of what they've positioned. And, you know, investors remember that. Their job, they're very detail oriented. So I think part of that is, you know, getting the right message strategy, trying to communicate clearly to the constituents that you're talking to, and recognizing that you've got to understand your audience, but it's got to be consistent. So that's something I think that is applicable.
As you're saying that, you were leading right up to the edge of a live performance experience I've had a lot, where you've got a set list, you've got your PowerPoint, right? Your slide you're going to do, and you get to a place where you're like, this room is not reacting to this at all. We need to change it. I was recently at, this is going to sound like a name drop, but I have a good story with it. I was recently at the Berkshire Hathaway meeting, it was kind of a circus to go watch. And they were introducing the people who are in line to take over the company after Charlie and Warren, at least aren't interested in running the company anymore. And one of the guys was completely had the same tone and feel and message as the other guys. And the other person who's in line for it, I think really read the room wrong. It felt weird to me, and just kept doubling down and going deeper and deeper. And I'm sure, whatever, who am I to say, but there's something about reading the room that I think as a musician, you feel it and you need to be able to shift to the other thing. You can't just stay on the train tracks and plow through it. Or as you're saying that, you give people the wrong taste and it's kind of hard to recover.
It's great. Now everybody likes different stuff, but for me, while I love the Eagles, I have no desire mm-hmm. to see them in concert, because they literally play everything scripted. It's note for note.
There'll be no surprise. There's no surprise. Right?
No note
surprise.
For note. Yep. Even the jokes or the crowd banter seems to be relatively scripted. And there's nothing. It's a performance.
An amazing great, performance.
But when I go see them more right? than once, no, they're going to play the exact same show. But when you go see a band who's got it in the moment, figure out what's mm-hmm. going on. To your point, set list change. Thing the environment changes. I'll just tell you a quick funny story here. 2019, my wife and I were out at Boulder seeing Dead & Company at the stadium. And they've got set lists now. They're not walking on stage anymore figuring out, hey, what should we play today, right?
So
right after the second song, as the weather in Colorado changes pretty quickly. So it went from mm-hmm. a beautiful day to hailing and severe thunderstorms. So besides that, they evacuated the stadium and all the fun that goes along with that.
Yeah.
They basically changed the set list because we saw it crossed out the next day, adding more songs that were more relevant to the weather experience that we were dealing with. And may sound a little bit cheesy, but I got to tell you, everybody after being soaked for an hour or so is like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I heard this story, and I hope this person is still actively playing, because I want to see this happen. And so apparently the Willie Nelson Band doesn't play with a set list, and Willie's in charge of what they're going to play, and he doesn't even say the song. He'll just walk up to the mic and start playing. And they've been playing together. They're, you know, those are the kind of bands that have been together for 40 years or something. And, you know, they can tell by his shoulders or where it's going to be, you know, whatever. And he'll just start playing and it'll be any one of the 500 songs or however many they know that they've ever played. And they're all expected to just go right into it. And it's a in the moment, always present set list. I want to see that happen because I almost don't believe it, but it's kind of an amazing extreme version.
It's either that or they're also on the same wavelength with Willie's special blend of weed.
Yeah.
That they're all connected in that manner.
Yeah. You know, earlier you were talking about creativity, which I think is a great the great commonality between music and business. And there is an element of if you've ever done like the improv stuff with like the yes and part of the improv, and then there, so you have to build the ideas and you have to kind of whittle them down. And I think some people, have an impression that in those sessions, every idea has to be right or great. And they're nervous about, kind of putting something out there. And so when you were talking about creativity earlier, you know, what's your experience like with that sort of like building creativity and then reining it in and focusing on something that's going to work?
You know, one good example, and I think all of us in tech have been getting a lot smarter over this the last 10, 15 years, is the concept of product market fit. And nobody's bereft of ideas, right? With especially if you're in tech and whether you're on the engineering side or the sales side, all of those inputs, right? Like we could do this or we could do that, or you know, wouldn't it be great if? These are all good ideas. Mm-hmm. And I think oftentimes in the past, and it still goes on today to a certain extent, is not validating or checking those out, how good they are, and getting that that level of data. So often have the workshops we do with our clients, and then the data we do, there are no bad ideas. There are just ideas, and some of them have got legs, and some of them you're like, wow, that's really out there. We're going to put that in the parking lot. It's creating enough space to figure that out. But here's the part the next part that's important, especially, you know, if you and I are playing and we go off on a tangent, there's not a lot of downside to that didn't work out. Oh, that didn't work. You know, wow. Mm-hmm. Don't go there, because that was right. Harmonically unpleasing. In business, if you don't check things out, it could have catastrophic effects.
Oh yeah.
And I think about how many companies that I had the opportunity to look at working with venture capital shops and family offices and PE shops. And these are really smart people who came up with an idea that they thought was a product and it was really a feature. And had they spent a little bit more time checking that out, not a bad idea, but you can't build a business around that. And you become so insular and so believing your own thesis, if you will.
Yeah.
So I think that's where there's good creativity, but at some point, go check it out. And, you know, it's sort of tied to your risk tolerance as well, you know. Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting, because I feel like at the risk of plugging, you know, both of us as third-party advisors, there is a value to coming in and looking at it. Because I know a lot of the things that that we see from perspective ideas is that, you're right, it's a feature, or that's not the whole idea. That's not a whole business we're talking about. Or, you know, we see a lot of – that's a really limited market. That's a marketplace of, you know, 10 or 100 people and not a million kind of thing. And so helping them whittle down and understand that product market fit, I think that's really where the maturity has come in the last 5 or 10 years or something, has been instead of throwing everything out there, let's examine this a little more closely, test it a little bit, you know, see if there's something real out there.
Yeah, you know, just off that thread, Michael, I can't tell you how many businesses that I saw where they're building the next great app for Salesforce or SAP or Oracle. Right. And like, hey, that's kind of interesting, but you know, that's a feature. And if Salesforce desired to do that, you know, it's just time and money.
Just do it.
I think the challenge is that the framework by which you set yourself up for success. And to your point about this outside perspective, I would say probably 75% of the time we're talking to founders who've been in their businesses and they are masters of their domain. They know everything about their business. They know every customer. They know their team members. They know their financials.
Yep, yep.
But it is an inside outlook of the world. Like, you know, when you go to sell your house, you think your house looks great. And the broker comes in and goes, you know, you got to take this stuff off the walls. Oh, I love that. No, no. But the buyers, the pictures of great grandma and that collection of, you know, antique matchbook covers is great, but that's not going to sell the house.
Right.
And I think for most privately held businesses, and we're no different, you want to get somebody to give you an outside perspective. Here's what you look like from the outside. Mm-hmm. And it takes a bit of open-mindedness and self-awareness to be okay with that. And some people, like, that's not their jam. They don't want to go down that path, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But we've encouraged, and I think that the clients we've worked best with, and I think I know from talking to you on a couple of things we've worked on together, that outside perspective is really important, because what we bring to the table is the collective mass of all the deals we've done.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We've seen 100 products like this or in this vein. Right. Yeah. That openness to, I don't know what the right concept is. If it's sort of, you know, being self-aware maybe, or being open to getting that criticism. Cause you're right about the, you know, when people come into your house, this is how you like it. And one of the things that we talk about a lot from like user experience point of view is this concept that you are not the user, that, you know, you can't build a product around what you want. You have to figure out, we come back to this product market fit idea again. Is there a big enough market out there that this thing would actually be viable for? And it's not just your pet thing, your pet project. It's got to be, you know, something.
You know, it's interesting on that theme. I've seen some really cool stuff that engineers have problems they've solved, except it's not the problem the clients want to solve right now. And it's hard if you've never carried a bag or you've done the customer facing journey mapping work.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it's very hard for these really creative engineering types. Like, maybe you just can't sell it. It's got to be a sales problem, because this product is rock solid. In some cases, that is true. In some cases, the message is bad.
Yeah.
Sales is bad. But in other cases, it's kind of not what the market wants. And the market wants a derivative, or it's a great idea, but it's 3 years down the road. What else can we do in the interim until the market catches up?
Right. All right. That's interesting. Well, so maybe let's wrap it there. This has been a great conversation. I love your insights, and I thought we were weaving our music stuff in and out pretty well. It was actually
same here,
a
Michael.
Lot of fun.
Thanks for the opportunity.
The Leadership Superpowered podcast is brought to you by Caxi Interactive, a custom software development company focused on helping mid-market companies achieve enterprise value through creating custom software that optimizes their business, creates huge leaps in customer experience, and widens their moat of differentiation in the market.